And talking of Into the Music, it all started with a three-piece rock band, but Sting's musical career has seen him progressively play with more and more musicians, so much so that he now performs with a full symphony orchestra. From his early career as the frontman of The Police to his expansive solo career, Sting has managed to stay touring and reinventing his music for 30 years now. He's been playing around Australia recently with a series of shows called Symphonicity. And Julian Morrow spoke with Sting yesterday, fresh from a soundcheck with his latest backing band, the Sydney Symphony.
Meeting an orchestra for the first time in the afternoon and then playing a concert ball in the evening. It's one of the miracles of the symphony orchestra that they just look at the music and they play it almost as if you press record, you know, in a studio. So that's a miracle, and I love that. And then you get the national characteristics of, you know, each orchestra. I played with the Korean National Orchestra and the Tokyo Symphony. Tonight's the Sydney Symphony. Last night was the Melbourne Symphony. And they're all slightly different. They are, the way they approach the music, the seriousness of it. You know, I mean, the Australians have a good time when they play, right, which is really what I want. The Koreans are wild. The Tokyo Orchestra is very serious, you know, absolutely rigid. But it's interesting standing in front of a symphony and singing. You know, it's like being tied at the front of a train, and there's all this incredibly rich texture going on. You know, when I'm used to playing with a rock band, it's just three primary colors, basically, red, blue, and green. The spectrum of color in a symphony orchestra is so exciting. So I'm having the time of my life, and we've done about 90 shows like this.
Wow.
And, you know, I sing for 3 hours, and I could do this for the rest of my life. I love it.
And do you find that your relationship with the orchestra evolves over time?
Well, I think normally when a pop performer, you know, uses an orchestra, it's often just as background, you know, like wallpaper. But I demanded that these arrangements were going to be difficult, so the musicians would be challenged by the music rhythmically and in terms of focus. So they have to concentrate as if they were playing Stravinsky. So they're not just playing long notes behind a ballad. They're really having to work, and the steam coming out of their ears. Yeah. And they love it. So, you know, they're engaged. The audience like to see that, and I have the time of my life, so fantastic.
And they don't just have to play. There's a bit of kind of orchestral choreography going on as well. How do they react to having to move also?
I think they enjoy that too, yeah. You know, and also I bring the soloists out, and of course a rock audience will applaud the soloist when he's playing, which is very unusual in classical music. It's never done. People just remain silent. So that they enjoy that. So at the end of the day, they don't want to go back to Marla. They want to come join the circus with me. But
and are they as perfectionist about their dance moves as they are about their stringing and the like?
They are. They get into it.
So how did this project come about? I mean, you mentioned that, you know, symphonic arrangements of pop music has been a bit of a trend over time, but how did it come to you?
It actually came from the symphonic end. I was asked by the Chicago Symphony, who are one of the biggest bands in the world, to put together a program of my music, an hour's worth of my music, for a benefit, to benefit the Chicago Symphony. Right. And, you know, I like a challenge. And I said, sure, I will do that. And we got these arrangements done. I had a great time. The orchestra had a good time, and so did the audience. So I thought, if it works there, let's take this on the road. We were lucky enough to get the Royal Philharmonic from London, and we did 80 shows with them in North America and Europe. And I thought when we came to the Southern Hemisphere, we'd use Southern Hemisphere orchestras. So it's been a good decision. They've been fantastic. And I think we've got another 10 or so dates to do before I go back home and hang my violin up.
Do remember me when the west wind moves upon the fields of barley, and you forget the sun in his jealous sky when we walk in fields of gold.
And the benefit side of it originally for the Chicago Symphony, I suppose, to me, has some resonances with one of your venues. I mean, you're going up to Brisbane to perform up there, mm-hmm. a very unique time for Brisbane, and I know that you've done some things to help out the people of Brisbane. How do you think the tone of those concerts will differ?
I mean, it would be strange to go to somewhere like Brisbane that's had such a shock, mm. you know, such a trauma, and not deal with it, and you know, pretend everything's fine. It's not,
yeah.
And so you go there to entertain people, but you have to address what they've been through. So you know, I've made a personal donation. I've asked the promoters to do the same thing. We're giving tickets to the relief workers, you know, the people who've been working their butts off to try and put things back. You know, all throughout Australia, we've been collecting funds from the people, from the punters, to give to the people of Queensland and Victoria. And, you know, it's what society does, or what communities do. Mm. And, you know, I'm a part of the community, and so I feel like we need to address it.
You mentioned hanging up your violin. and I wanted to ask you about your time as a public figure. Obviously, first and foremost, you're a musician. You're well known, though, for your political activities, and you're successful enough that you could choose to do neither of those things anymore. How do you divide your time these days, and is the mix changing?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate because I have a job that I would do for nothing. I literally would do it for no money. That's a secret, though. I shouldn't tell anybody. And I get paid at the same time. So, you know, that's the only lesson I've given my children. I said, find a job like this. Find a job you love so much you would do it for no money. Because if you do it for money, or if you do it to be famous, you will fail. You play music because it's its own reward. And I've managed to balance that peripatetic life with my family life. You know, I have a very solid family life, and that keeps me in balance. One doesn't work without the other. I think if I stayed at home, I'd go nuts. But if I was on the road without the family, yeah. I'd also go nuts. So I have a nice balance between the two things. And, you know, that's really just keeping a balance.
You've obviously been a very prominent advocate for human rights and for political change. Do you have any thoughts on the situation in Egypt at the moment?
Very interesting. I mean, it's very interesting that, you know, that society is being tied down by this very repressive government. But, you know, it's been our ally, so we've supported that. And now that seems to be up for grabs, you know. And what replaces that is just very interesting. I mean, I hope for the best.
Look, I mean, I'm not a big one for kind of slamming people like Al Gore every time he burns a bit of jet fuel or anything like that. But people who, you know, profess progressive views, perhaps understandably, are often held to much higher standards. Do you feel a tension between your environmentalist beliefs and the lifestyle of an international entertainer?
You know, I've got a huge carbon footprint. You know, I fly around all the time. I travel musicians all the time. Do I have an excuse? You know, there are economies of scale. We do play to the millions of people, and, you know, that's...
Your reach is pretty good.
And I also try and ameliorate the problem I'm causing by, you know, planting trees and trying to protect large amounts of rainforest. But no, it's not perfect at all, you know, and yeah, the criticism is justified. But I'm not given an alternative to do this life without burning fuel.
Indeed, yeah.
And I think we've got to figure that out as a society, and not necessarily to look for scapegoats. You can make the point, but, you know, let's find a solution.
Does it make you more inclined to look for high-tech solutions to environmental issues that will enable everyone to still keep flying around?
You know, the world is the universe is full of energy. It's an energy machine. We should be able to access it without burning fuel, but burning fossil fuel. It's such a primitive way to go about it. The world is absolutely full of energy, and it's up to us to figure out how to use it.
You've obviously thought about the relationship between fame and activism. What's your take on the benefits of it, and what are the limits?
Well, you know, I never set out to be famous. I set out to make a living as a musician. That's really what I do. The fame sort of came along. And I'd had a real life before I became famous. You know, I was a school teacher until I was 26.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I had a pension. I paid taxes.
It's good to know you got something to fall back on.
I voted. I was a father. I was a husband. So I had a real life. So in a sense that when fame came along and all that, that lunacy came along, I had something to ground me. I had something to judge it by. I worry that people now, you know, get on these sort of talent shows on TV and they become celebrated instantly. I'm not sure where that goes. It worries me.
Yeah.
I think they're exploited.
I just Don't drink coffee, I take tea, my dear. I like my toast done on one side. But you can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York.
In terms of the music that you're playing on this tour, I mean, obviously it's a catalogue of your greatest hits over the years. Do you get tired of that sometimes, or do you just enjoy playing the classics and making people happy with that?
You know, it's my job to sing a song that I may have written 35 years ago with as much energy and commitment and a sense of discovery as if I'd written it this afternoon. So I'm singing Roxanne tonight. I'm not sure which, somewhere in the 70s I wrote that song. I look at that song every night and go, there's something to find here. There's some fresh little nuance that maybe the punters out there won't hear, but I hear it, and that excites me. So I'm always finding new things. Also, working with a whole different set of musicians gives you this completely different perspective. So it changes the meaning of the song, both subtly and quite profoundly, too, having a different set of musicians work on it. And I think songs are like living organisms. You know, if you treat them like museum pieces, then they die. And you put them on a plinth, that has to be just that way. I'm not like that. I'm an old jazzer. You know, I like things to be different every night.
Do you have your own sentimental favourites in the collection, or is that classified information?
Well, that's like asking me what, you know, which is my favourite child. You know, I have six
kids.
Which
is your favourite child?
I don't have a favourite child. They're all different. I love them unconditionally.
And the same goes for the songs?
In a way, it's all one song.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they might be in different keys, they might have different tempos, but, you know, I'm really singing the story of my life.
He's so easy to listen to, isn't he? That's Sting speaking with Julian Morrow yesterday after a dress rehearsal for that concert with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to RM Breakfast. It's 8:25.